Welcome to the IYBA's podcast channel, powered by Robert Allen Law, The Yacht Lawyers. Each week, we release discussions from our past conferences, summits, and educational events specifically related to the yacht brokerage community. With more than 1,800 members and growing, the International Yacht Brokers Association, IYBA, is the world's largest and most influential association for the yacht brokerage and charter industry. IYBA is dedicated to professionalism and ethics in all aspects of yacht transactions. This week, our segment comes from Yacht Sales Summit 2021.
Okay, so rolling right into this. And we have Adrian Carbarani of Robert Allen Law with us right now. He's an associate at the firm where he works in corporate yacht law and litigation departments. Focuses on yacht transactions, litigation, secured maritime finance, corporate law. And he's going to talk to us about contracts, MIBA, IBA, and YABA, I think it is. So let's hear it for Adrian Carbarani. Thanks, Mike. Thank you, Mike.
Good afternoon. So before I begin, I'd like to thank Paul and the IYBA for inviting me to speak here today, and to our sponsors who enabled events like this to happen, take place. I'd also like to thank Mark Norman from our firm who helped me put together this presentation. And I'd like to share something with you guys. You know, I got up this morning and I thought, gee, Adrian, you're one lucky dude to have the opportunity to get up in front of this room of well-respected professionals and give this presentation on contracts. Thank you. I mean, really, I could have easily been one of you stuck listening to me for the next 30 minutes about where to put a comma. I'm just kidding. It's not going to be that entertaining. So without further ado.
We thought we'd roll out a once in a lifetime business opportunity.
Happy birthday, Derek.
Music.
Prestige. Worldwide. Why?
Prestige worldwide.
So I also got up this morning and thought, I'm probably never going to have the opportunity to put Will Ferrell in a presentation again. And I was really excited to share that with you guys. Anyways, in all seriousness, today's presentation, I thought we would narrow the scope a little bit. Worldwide contract analysis seems a little bit of a large topic to cover in 30 minutes. So I decided we should focus on just a few contracts, specifically the most popular purchase and sale agreements in our industry, the IBA, the MIBA, and the YABA. So my goal during our time together is to educate you a little, or as the case may be for some of you, to give you a refresher on the benefits and pitfalls of the different forms. I won't be able to highlight everything, all the differences, or all the protections, but I will try to cover the points that I think are the most important for you to be aware of and so you can properly educate your clients. That being said, as a broker, it helps to have a knowledge of the basic difference between the forms. And it also makes you look good in front of your clients when they ask these questions. And I guess another bright line rule I'd like to establish here is since we're going to be discussing three different forms, I'll be using the IYBA as the base form because it's the best. Where's Paul? And the other ones will be comparing to that. And that's not only because it makes things easier to highlight and to follow along, but because you guys probably have the most exposure and experience with the IYBA form. With that said, let's kick things off. And the first thing that I want you to notice is the difference in the page numbers. The IYBA is 4 pages, the YABA is 5 pages, and the MIBA's 11 pages. Right? Oh, so you know there's this joke about lawyers not knowing how to do math, right? And I think it's true. But in this case, the MEBA form comes with 8 pages part of its standard package, and then you have a 3-page addendum, bringing the total to 11 pages. So is that a big deal? Seems like it's not, but I mean, isn't it easier for you as the broker to read all the legal mumbo jumbo in 4 pages rather than 5 or 11? I mean, yeah, maybe. I mean, you're the broker, right? You're supposed to know what's in these contracts that you're presenting to your clients and what they're signing. On that point, let me add that the MEBA is written in English, but if you've read it, you'd swear that it wasn't, because it's written in UK English and legalese. So anyways, that's what I would call the superficial contrast of the forms. Now let's get to the meat and potatoes, if you will, the substance. To be clear, reading through these agreements is tedious. It's a lot of boring legal stuff, and it's actually hard to stay awake reading one straight through. Trust me, I know, I did it the other day. I'm going to do my best to keep you awake, but I make no promises. Expressed or implied, as the lawyers would say. So this is gonna be our roadmap for what we're gonna be discussing today. The points that I'm gonna try to isolate and focus on for you guys. There aren't too many, as you can see, but they're important, and they have significant legal effects on the deal. And as we go through these differences, I'm gonna try to highlight why it matters for your clients and how it affects whether you, the broker, get paid. Okay, so let's start off at the beginning of the deal with the deposit. Specifically, when is the deposit due, who holds it, and how much is required? Under the EBA, deposits due within 3 business days of the seller executing the contract, the selling broker will hold the deposit, and the amount of the deposit is whatever the parties agree to. It gives you flexibility. Under the YABA, the deposit is due upon execution. It's held by the selling broker, and it's whatever you guys agree to, like the EBA. Now the MEBA here, it's due within 4 banking days after the buyer's signature. It's held by the, so that means even if the seller doesn't countersign, it is held by the stakeholder. More on that in a bit. And it's a fixed 10% of the purchase price. So let's dig in here a little bit and see what this means. Under the EBA, the contract signed by the seller, we have a deal. We do not need to wait for the deposit to hit. The selling broker holds the deposit, and the amount of deposit can be negotiated. It's pretty flexible. Under the YABA, things are a little different because deposit's required upon execution, and the YABA contains a time is of the essence clause, which in layman's terms means that upon any party's breach of a deadline, it's deemed a material breach of the contract, and you know, you could potentially have a buyer that's in default. So when considering the deposit, if it's not made upon execution, then the contract is already dead, or worse, as I just explained, the buyer's in breach. Here you have to be careful, because failing to tender the deposit with the offer could be used to give the seller the ability to back out. In essence, the deal could be dead just as you got it off the ground. So if you're using a YABA, I'd recommend an amendment to give the buyer at least 3 business days to make the deposit. And like the EBA, under the YABA, the deposit's held by the selling broker, which is good, because in the event of a dispute, you have possession of the deposit. And that matters, because as I'm sure as you've heard, possession is 9/10 of the law. And that's especially true in commission disputes. Also, like the EBA, the deposit is negotiable, so it gives the buyer additional flexibility. Looking now at the MEBA, the deposit is due within 4 banking days. The deposit is held by the stakeholder, which is the broker listed as broker one on the contract. Excuse me. This is usually the listing broker, but it can be negotiated. However, giving the seller the option to have the buyer's funds held by the listing broker will usually be a point that you have to negotiate, and could lose if you're representing a buyer, so be prepared for that. The other significant point as it relates to the deposit is that under the IBA and the YABA, the selling broker gets to pay the commission out of the deposit, where in the MIBA, the deposit is paid to the seller with the rest of the proceeds. So you as the broker, under the IBA and the YABA, can pay your commission right out of the deposit. Under the MIBA, you can't. You're not authorized. To summarize, the IBA provides the most flexibility and commercially reasonable terms. The YABA is a close second, but as I mentioned, I'd recommend amending to give your buyer more time to make the deposit. And the MIBA is the least flexible, with the possibility for dispute over who holds the deposit and for how much the deposit is. Now let's look at how the forms handle what happens if a buyer doesn't pay a deposit. So we regularly say that on the one hand, the IBA is a buyer-friendly form, and on the other, the MIBA is the seller-friendly form, which in most respects is true. But the key here is the IBA is a buyer-friendly form to serious buyers, not buyers who are going to waste your time. Why? Well, under the IBA, if the buyer doesn't pay the deposit, the buyer agrees to pay agreed and liquidated damages to the seller and the brokers the amount of the deposit. 50% to the seller, 25% to each broker. I call this the hammer. And it holds the buyer accountable and prevents frivolous offers that tie up boats. How does the YABA handle it? Actually, I want to come back to that one. Under the MIBA, I'd say the MIBA has no hammer. Why? Under the MIBA, the buyer fails to to make the deposit, the seller can cancel and has a claim for provable losses and expenses reasonably incurred. Good luck to the seller proving his losses and not going broke paying a lawyer to try to prove those damages. The MIBA has no hammer. Which brings us back to the YABA. That's actually silent on the issue. Doesn't say. So you're actually in the same position as the MIBA, trying to prove your damages in front of a court. So in essence, YABA has no hammer either. Okay, so if I lost you before on this deposit stuff, that's okay. But this is the part that I think you need to pay attention to. This is the real, this is where you as a broker can get tripped up. This is where you can have a client accepting a boat that they didn't intend to accept. And so this is the stuff that I really recommend you take away. So looking at the terms associated with a sea trial, survey, and acceptance, all three forms are generally the same in this regard. Okay, you have the running risks that are of any sea trial borne by the seller. The risk of loss remains with the seller until closing. Note that there's a little wonky provision in the MIBA that we'll discuss soon. And survey costs are generally the responsibility of the buyer. Standard stuff, right? However, the MIBA differs drastically from the IBA and the YABA on how sea trials and surveys are treated and the effect they have on the rest of the deal. Under the IBA and the YABA, the forms are generally the same in that the buyer may perform a survey and sea trial. And pending the results, the buyer may tender his acceptance or rejection. But the key is, under the IBA and the YABA, the buyer must affirmatively accept the boat or it's deemed rejected. Okay? That is the key. If the buyer does not transmit acceptance, the boat is deemed rejected. The contract is canceled, deposits are returned, and everybody goes on their way. Oh, and I said that the IBA and the YABA are actually generally the same. The YABA doesn't actually guarantee the right of the buyer to sea trial the boat, which is interesting. And I checked this a few times. It implies it, but it doesn't actually expressly state that the buyer can sea trial the boat. Now, if it's something that's up for debate, It can generally be something that evolves into a dispute, which is why I'm highlighting it for you. The reality of the situation is, if the seller doesn't allow the buyer to see trial the boat, the buyer rejects the boat and the deal's dead. But I just wanted to let you know. So, again, this is the key. Keep in mind that under the MIBA, if the buyer does not transmit notice of rejection, he's deemed to have accepted the boat. It's the exact inverse case here. Now, that's not the only thing that can trip you up. And I'll get to that in just a moment. But under the MIBA, the procedure for sea trial and survey are bifurcated. They're completely separated, and the sea trial has to come first, and the survey comes second. And this is where it gets tricky. I'm telling you that you have to be prepared and understand this procedure, or you can end up with a client who falls into one of the traps I'm about to discuss with you and ends up accepting a boat he didn't mean to accept. So the first trap. So let's say our buyer decides not to do a sea trial, which, you know, it could happen. The MIBA states that he's deemed to have accepted the boat subject only to the condition survey. Now let me say that again. Under the MIBA, if the buyer does not sea trial the boat, he's deemed to have accepted the boat subject only to the condition survey. Now, I'm going to tell you right now that the condition survey does not give your client flexibility to back out for any reason like the IBA and the YABA. In fact, the MIBA states that the buyer can only back out for defects, which is a term of art defined in the contract. So let's look at this together. A defect, under Clause 27, a defect shall be regarded as a defect for the purposes of this Clause 27 if an officially appointed marine surveyor, to be defined as a marine surveyor whose day-to-day business is occupied with the surveying of vessels of a similar quality to and value of the vessel, shall have certified in writing that the defects affects the operational integrity of the vessel or her machinery or her systems or renders the vessel unseaworthy. So what does this mean? Well, it means you won't be able to call up your friend, the surveyor, to look at the boat, because there's probably going to be an argument about whether they're qualified and they have the right credentials. And when I say friend, I mean qualified surveyor that you use regularly and you trust. It also means the possibility of argument over something that affects the operational integrity of the vessel or its machinery. I'm not even going to try to figure out what that means. I'm guessing it's something catastrophic, like a hole in the side of the boat or blown engines. And then there's the possibility of argument over whether something affects seaworthiness. Now, you might be wondering, is that it? It doesn't seem too bad. Well, I'm going to tell you that we're only talking about the first of three traps here. And no, that's not it for trap number one. The term defects does not include defects that were disclosed to the buyer prior to the contract, or prior to signing the contract, before the survey. So before you get an opportunity to see what the defect is, to really, he tells you something happened, there's something wrong with the boat, before you really get to dig in and see what it is and inspect it, you've already been deemed to accept it. That's a big one. So this means we're also having arguments about whether something was disclosed. And I'm of the opinion that this clause was made overly complicated. I'm talking about this whole section 27. To keep the lawyers in business. And I don't mean the American lawyers, but I'll talk more about that later. So if that wasn't enough, worrisome enough, rather, let's talk about trap number two. This time, let's pretend your client sea trials the boat, so you think, okay, he's no longer deemed to have accepted the boat, which is good, but does he now have the option to walk away like the IBA and the YABA? And the answer is, well, it depends. And it depends on what happens after the sea trial. So let's look at this together. Clause 26 states, notwithstanding what is contained elsewhere in this agreement, for any reason whatsoever, and in his discretion, the buyer considers that the vessel has not performed to his satisfaction on the sea trial, and he does not therefore wish to proceed with the purchase, he shall give written notice of his rejection of the vessel to the seller or the broker, and this is the key, within 24 hours of completion of the sea trial or prior to placing the vessel ashore for the condition surveys, whichever shall be sooner. Okay, so that's a little loaded, right? Let's unpack that a bit. It basically says your buyer has 24 hours from the completion of the survey to tender rejection of the vessel, or in the event that the boat is going to be hauled out for a survey, if it's less than 24 hours, before that takes place. So it's a period that can be considerably shorter than 24 hours, and if you don't tender the rejection, your buyer is deemed to have accepted the vessel, subject only to the condition survey, which, as we just discussed, has plenty of pitfalls of its own. The other thing I'd like to point out is that this 24-hour window means that your client is not going to have the opportunity to receive and review any written findings, any report that's generated during the sea trial. There's just not enough time. It's 24 hours.